but unsound arguments, and pegged them as the sophists that they were. Now, sophistry is a related word you will encounter that refers to the act of intentionally attempting to deceive someone with tricky, intellectually dishonest arguments. Sophist comes from the Greek root S-O-P-H, soph, meaning wise, and skilled, clever. For sophists, the emphasis is not on the wise, it's on the skilled, and particularly the clever. The sophists were professional, itinerant teachers in ancient Greece who taught, among other things, rhetoric, or the art of persuasive speaking and writing. Now, these sophists were known for their clever, but not necessarily logical arguments. Their detractors claim that sophists weren't on a journey to find the truth. They were simply trying to persuade others by any argumentative trick or intellectual sleight of hand that would enable them to win. So in this light, you can see how sophist became a term of contempt. Being called a sophist is most definitely not a compliment. Okay. So now, what other related words do you already know that also begin with the S-O-P-H root? How about sophomore? A sophomore contains the same Greek root and literally means wise fool. Sophos means wise, and moros means foolish, and is the root from which the word moron is derived. Now, because sophomores have been in school just long enough to think that they know it all, some consider wise or clever fools an apt description for a sophomore. Okay, we just used the related word strategy, another powerful strategy for your vocabulary toolbox that's based on the spelling, meaning, connection. When you encounter or learn a new, unfamiliar word, I want you to try and connect it with a word you already know that's spelled the same and or that sounds the same. Now, we're going to use this related words strategy a lot in this course. So the next time you hear the word sophist, think of the initial part, S-O-P-H, in the word sophomore, which means wise and clever. And you'll remember that sophists were clever, tricky debaters and persuaders. Okay, we've just discussed two types of deceivers who don't always tell the whole truth, mountebanks and sophists. Now, what can we call the arguments and claims made by mountebanks and sophists? Let's explore three words for untrue claims and stories. Now, as we've seen, sophists can be described as clever debaters who attempt to deceive you with plausible but unfounded arguments. So what might we call the type of argument delivered by a sophist? An argument that looks plausible on the surface, but that is actually fallacious underneath. The answer is our next target word, specious. Now, specious is an adjective that means having the ring of truth or plausibility, but actually fallacious. Specious claims appear plausible, but they're actually false. Specious is often used to describe arguments that aren't simply false. They are, and this is the important distinction, deceptively plausible. Arguments that look good on the surface, but really aren't when you analyze them and try to follow the chain of reasoning. They are intentionally misleading. So, the next time you see or hear a politician trying to persuade you with an argument that is deceptively plausible, but plays fast and loose with the facts, you can impress your friends by saying, "That sophist sure is spewing forth specious arguments. I won't trust another word," he says. Now, specious comes from the Latin speciosus, meaning good-looking, which comes from species, meaning appearance. So a specious argument is an argument that appears or looks good on the surface, but really isn't. And specious is also related to a Latin root we've already explored, spec, meaning look. So to remember this word's meaning, I want you to highlight the spec in specious in your vocabulary notebook and connect it to the root spec, meaning look. You could also draw a picture of spectacles, our key word for spec, to remind you that specious arguments look good, but aren't. Now also remember, one of our principles of vocabulary learning, chunking. Chunking words that are semantically related or related by meaning. It's kind of like a library. If we store all our vocabulary words or books by the same meaning or topic, it's much easier to find these words when we need them. So, think of the target words sophist and specious together. A sophist delivers specious or misleading arguments. Okay, our next target word is spurious. Spurious is often used as a synonym for specious, but it actually has a slightly different connotation. Now, of course, there is no such thing as an exact synonym in English. If two words meant exactly the same thing, we wouldn't need them both, would we? Now, spurious is an adjective that means not genuine or authentic. False. So, like specious, spurious can refer to something, like an argument or claim, that is false, not genuine. So, what's the main difference between specious and spurious? Okay, now I warn you, it is not a clear-cut black and white difference in meaning, but rather a difference in emphasis. And here it is. Specious clearly implies fraud and intentional deception. Spurious does not necessarily imply fraud or intentional deception. So, a spurious argument could be false and misleading, but it could also be a false argument that's just an honest mistake. Now, in contrast to that, specious arguments are definitely intended to deceive you. Okay? So to sum up the differences, if you want to emphasize that a false argument looked good, but was intentionally misleading, specious would be the better choice. If you want to emphasize that a false argument or claim is obviously false, or was an honest mistake, spurious would probably be the better choice. Okay, now this brings me to collocates. Collocates are words that commonly occur together. They are co-located next to each other. So, what words would you likely see specious and spurious used with? What common phrases might you hear them used in? Well, you might hear of a specious argument, or you might hear of spurious reasoning in a political debate, or of spurious charges in a high-profile court case. Argument, reasoning, charges. These are collocates with our target words. So, write these collocates and common phrases down in your vocabulary notebook. Identifying collocates is very helpful in learning vocabulary. When you want to go out and actually use a target word, it's really helpful to know what other words the target word is often used with. Remember, words live in context, so it makes sense to study them in context. Okay, our next target word is apocryphal. Now, I'm going to tell you an apocryphal story, and then see if you can figure out what this word means. Okay, now this story was told to me by my Uncle John, and he heard it from a friend of a friend, who said it was originally passed down from his second cousin's grandmother. Now, according to this story, it was once not uncommon for New Yorkers vacationing in Florida to bring back baby alligators as pets for their children. Of course, what these short-sighted parents didn't plan for was the fact that these cute little creatures would grow to be too large and dangerous to keep. So eventually, they flushed them down the toilets into the sewers of New York City, where they bred and produced colonies of albino alligators with bulging eyes who to this day thrive underneath the city that never sleeps. Now, do you believe this story? Do you think there might be even a kernel of truth in it? Is there any way to confirm its veracity? Well, this is an apocryphal story. Apocryphal is an adjective that means of doubtful or dubious authenticity. False. A lot of urban legends like this alligator tale are apocryphal. Now, use the word apocryphal if you want to emphasize that the story or claim is not only probably false, but it's difficult to verify or even find evidence for. Think of how hard it would be to verify this story as I claim to have heard it from my Uncle John, who heard it from a friend of a friend's second cousin's grandmother. Now, originally, the Apocrypha were texts that were not included in the Bible because their authenticity could not be firmly established. Today, apocryphal stories, like the urban legend that I just told you, are referred to as apocryphal because they can't be verified. and are therefore of doubtful authenticity. So some other apocryphal stories that you might have heard include a woman who, unbeknownst to her, had a nest of poisonous spiders living in her massive hairdo. Or the tales of Bigfoot, the hominid-like creature some believe lives in the Pacific Northwest. When you hear the word apocryphal, think of urban legends like this that can't be verified. Okay, let's review our first five target words. Mountebank, sophist, specious, spurious, and apocryphal. Now, I'm going to give you a situation, and you try and identify which of the five words best describes that situation. Okay, situation one. You are a history professor grading a paper written by Kevin, an extremely honest student who is struggling in your U.S. history class. Now, you realize that Kevin's argument in his essay, while not intentionally misleading, is very obviously illogical and false. It's clearly not valid. Would Kevin's argument be best characterized as specious or spurious? Why? If you answered spurious, you're correct. Spurious can refer to an obviously false argument and or a false argument that is not intended to deceive, whereas specious includes the connotation of a claim, argument, or story that appears to be valid, that looks good, but it's actually deceptive and false underneath. Okay, situation two. You're in your favorite coffee shop, just sitting down to a cup of joe and a mouth-watering chocolate croissant when a man running for town dog catcher struts in, sits down, and tries to persuade you to vote for him in the upcoming election. At first, his arguments appear convincing, but as you and others question him, you slowly begin to realize that he's intentionally trying to deceive you, twisting his opponent's words and citing facts that simply aren't true. Would you call this person a sophist or a mountebank? If you said sophist, you're correct. A sophist tries to convince you with clever arguments that sound wise at first, but are not necessarily sound. Sophists deliver specious arguments. Okay, situation three. You're sitting at home on a quiet Saturday afternoon when you hear a knock at the door. You open it to a fast-talking, flamboyant salesman who claims to be in the medical profession, and he's trying to sell you a super vitamin that he claims, if you take every day, would make you invincible to flus, colds, and coughs. The longer he talks, the more skeptical you become. What could you call this person? A mountebank. Okay, situation four. Have you ever heard the story about the vanishing hitchhiker? I first read this one on the internet, but I couldn't find any sources cited to verify it. It's a kindly motorist is driving down the road on a rainy night, and he comes upon a lonely hitchhiker. The kindly motorist decides to pick up the hitchhiker, who vanishes by the time they reach the hitchhiker's destination. And at the end of the story, the motorist actually meets the family of the hitchhiker, only to find out that the encounter took place on the anniversary of the hitchhiker's death, which was years ago. Which of our words might describe this doubtful story? Answer, apocryphal. Okay, for the second half of the lecture, we'll start by discussing two words that you can use to describe artificial, fake things. Now, the story about how our next word entered English is a wonderful example of English language's capacity to borrow and absorb words from other languages. So during World War II, British POWs who had been captured by the Nazis were, as you might imagine, not always served the best food. In fact, they were served Ersatzbrot, or substitute bread, made from low-quality potato starch, flour, and get this, even sawdust. They were also served Ersatz coffee, which wasn't the best quality either. When they got home after the war, these former British POWs began using the term Ersatz to describe anything that was of an inferior quality or substitute. So, our definition of Ersatz is, it's an adjective used to describe an inferior substitute for something. So, I want you to think of something in your life that you could have encountered or eaten or bought that was an inferior replacement or substitute. Now, my own family loves Heinz ketchup, and my children in particular love ketchup on their hot dogs and hamburgers. But one time, trying to save a little bit on groceries, we bought the generic brand of ketchup at the grocery store. Now, sometimes generic brands can be just as good as the brand names, but this particular ketchup was runny and thin. Needless to say, we had a near mutiny at the dinner table for my children over the ersatz ketchup. Now, I want you to think of a time that you bought or used a lower grade quality substitute for something else. Maybe it was a generic, less tasty beverage. Maybe it was an inferior piece of equipment, makeup, clothes, jewelry, or automobile. I want you to jot this personal connection down in your vocabulary notebook next to the word ersatz. Okay, now we've arrived at the final part of our lecture, my favorite part, where we're going to work with three target words that have to do with underhanded, dastardly deeds and doings. So what do you think our next target word, skullduggery, means? Do you think skullduggery refers to A, deceitful doings, underhanded, shady dealings, or B, a specific type of shady deed, namely the digging up of bodies, particularly skulls, to sell for body parts? If you said A, you were right. Skullduggery is a noun that means devious, deceitful behavior, underhanded dealings. As much as it sounds like it has something to do with digging up the dead, it doesn't. However, if this visual of someone digging up a body for the skull helps you to remember the more general meaning of the word, as it did for me when I first learned it, please use it as a visual reminder. Just remember and know that this word is a more general term for any kind of deceitful behavior, as in, the politician's campaign was rife with all forms of skullduggery, from wiretaps to bribes to spreading false rumors about his opponent. Skullduggery is a somewhat archaic word of Scottish origin, but is on Wayne State University's excellent Word Warriors list. Each year, these word warriors announce their list of great underused words to bring back. And you can nominate your own word for next year or look over the lively underused words that they've selected from previous years. Words, as they put it, that deserve retrieval from the linguistic closet. Okay, our next word is machinations. Do you think machinations means A, the machine-like, systematic destruction of something, or B, crafty schemes or plots? Now, before giving you the definition, let's give you a clue by putting machinations in context. The conspirators' machinations, devised in secret for years, led to the assassination of the president and two high-ranking members of his cabinet. Well, machinations is a noun that means intrigues, plots, crafty schemes, or the actual act of plotting. And you'll usually hear and see this word used in the plural. Also, you may hear it pronounced as machinations. Now, I remember this word by linking the first five letters, M-A-C-H-I, in machinations, to Machiavelli, the 15th and 16th century Italian historian, politician, and writer, who famously depicted unscrupulous politicians, those given to machinations and intrigue, in his classic work, The Prince. You might even encounter the phrase Machiavellian machinations. In fact, the word political is by far the most common collocate with machinations. Political machinations. Does that speak volumes about how many of us view politics? Devious, corrupt, and evil are other adjectives commonly found before the word machinations. Okay, I've saved my favorite word of the lecture for last. Hornswoggle. Go ahead and say it with me. Hornswoggle. It's just plain to fun to say, isn't it? Sort of rolls off the tongue. Hornswoggle is a verb that means to swindle, cheat, or dupe. Two great synonyms for hornswoggle are bamboozle and hoodwink. Also incredibly fun to say out loud. I've been bamboozled by that mountebank into buying a cure-all. Or, That sophist sure hoodwinked me with his clever arguments. Now, most sources report that Hornswoggle has no known origin beyond being an Americanism that entered American English in the early 1800s. However, I really like this one etymological narrative or story about the history of the word, although it's probably apocryphal. According to this story, as reported in vocabulary.com, Hornswoggle refers to how a lassoed cow would woggle or wiggle and shape its head in an attempt to free its horns and thus hornswoggle or cheat both the lasso and the cowboy. Even if this story can't be verified, it's a great visual to help you remember the meaning of the word hornswoggle. Now, you might hear a villain in an 1800s era tale of high adventure, after being outfoxed by the fast-thinking hero, exclaimed, "Hornswoggled again, by gad!" All right, let's review the four words we learned in the second part of our lecture. Ersatz, skullduggery, machinations, and hornswoggle. I'll provide you with the definition, and you identify which of the five words it goes with. To swindle, bamboozle, cheat, dupe, or trick. Answer: hornswoggle. Okay, next definition. An inferior substitute, like generic Dijon mustard that just can't be passed off for the real McCoy. Answer: ersatz. Okay, next definition. Crafty schemes or plots, often used with the term political. Answer: machinations. Okay, next definition. Deceitful, underhanded work. You will not necessarily need a shovel or spade to engage in this type of trickery, but you could. Answer: skullduggery. Now that we're done exploring the deceitful world of tricksters, connivers, and charlatans, I invite you to use these words as many times as possible in the next 2 to 3 days. Remember, the more you use these words while they're fresh, the more likely it is that you'll make them your own. Also, be on the lookout for world-to-word connections in the next few days. For example, look for a mountebank out there in the world, a flamboyant imposter or fraud who's trying to sell you something with extravagant claims. You might see this mountebank in an advertisement or in a TV sitcom, or read about him in a newspaper article. Or it might be a salesman you run into at your local appliance store. I want you to quickly jot down this experience or example in your vocabulary notebook next to the word mountebank. Then, the next time you're talking to a friend, use the target word in a sentence. Like, that mountebank in the appliance store tried to sell me a toaster oven that he claimed could make coffee and do the dishes. What a fraud. Yes, this may feel a bit contrived, but applying and using the word in context will cement the meaning of the word in your mental lexicon. And that brings us to the end of our lecture today. So until next time, I want you to keep your head on a swivel for sophists, mountebanks, and any other flim-flam artists who might try and swindle, scam, or hornswoggle you. See you next time.
Lecture 4. Words that express annoyance and disgust.
If you're a parent like me, as much as you love your children with all your heart, and as much as they love you, you know that there are times when you don't quite see eye to eye and may get annoyed with each other. Now, as the parent of a teenager, this is one of my absolute favorite quotes from Mark Twain. "When I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant I could hardly stand to have the old man around. But when I got to be 21, I was astonished at how much the old man had learned in 7 years." It's amazing how much the perspective of age changes how we view things, isn't it? The very same quality in a person that annoys us at one stage of our lives might not seem so bad later on. In this lecture, we'll explore words related to three categories of people and behaviors that we all deal with from time to time in our lives: the annoying, the offensive, and the sickly sweet. Along the way in today's lecture, we'll be answering the following questions. What's a gadfly? And does it have anything to do with an actual insect? And what does noisome have to do with noise? And what's the difference between maudlin and mawkish? Okay, let's get started. Our first two target words will focus on annoying people and their irksome, vexing, irritating, nettlesome, and downright exasperating behavior. So for our first target word, picture this situation. Okay, it's a Monday morning, 7:59 a.m., and you've just gotten to the office. You're completely exhausted from a hectic weekend, and you just want to quietly slip into your cubicle, sip your quadruple shot espresso, and slowly ease into the morning without actually having to interact with anyone. And then you see him across the office. It's Bill, the resident office pest. He's buzzing around the cubicles like a wasp, looking for something to nitpick about or someone to annoy. You quickly duck down behind the half wall of your cubicle, slide into your chair, and take your first sip. Ah, you think, home free. And then Bill suddenly pops out of nowhere. The game's up. He doesn't even bother to say good morning. He just launches right in, asking why your department didn't turn in the report that was due last Friday, questioning your comments at last week's meeting, and even critiquing your shoes and your haircut. What a pain in the neck. Your office buddy, Bill, is a gadfly, our first target word for today's lecture and one of my all-time favorites. Gadfly is a noun referring to a persistently annoying person who questions, critiques, and pesters. Sound familiar? Gadfly is a wonderfully useful word for all those irritating critics in our lives. They're constantly pestering, provoking, and annoying the rest of us with their criticisms, demands, requests, ideas, and schemes. I mean, you wish you could just swat them away, don't you? Now, gadfly is another one of those short, powerful compound words that says what it means. And it's easy to remember if you know the other original meaning of gadfly, which is an actual insect that annoys livestock, and get this, by biting and sucking their blood. Appropriate, huh? There's the answer to one of our introductory questions, and what a great visual to boot. So, the prefix gad in gadfly comes from an Old Norse word which means spike or nail, like a stinger. So to remember gadfly, I want you to picture an annoying person, you know, buzzing around you, pestering you, trying to sting you with their needling critiques and bothersome questions. And if it helps, sketch a quick picture of a fly with a big stinger in your vocabulary notebook. You may also see gadfly used alongside its collocate, political, a political gadfly. The Greek philosopher Socrates was a self-described gadfly, questioning the political state of Athens. According to Plato's Apology, Socrates saw Athens as a lazy horse that needed to be roused by his gadfly sting. Political gadflies, while annoying and provoking to those in power, do serve the purpose of keeping politicians on their toes. All right, let's put gadfly in context. The local political gadfly was constantly writing letters to the editor, showing up at town meetings, and buzzing around the courthouse. More informal synonyms for gadfly include nag, pest, and thorn in the side. And a wonderful synonym for gadfly that I really love is a word borrowed from Yiddish, nudnik, a dull, boring pest. So, if you know someone who's not only an annoying gadfly, but also dull and boring to boot, nudnik's your word. I mean, boy, annoying and boring. What a great combination. Okay, let's move from gadflies and nudniks to another category of annoying people we all know, the constant complainers, the whiners and bellyachers. If you live in a neighborhood, these are your fault-finding neighbors who are constantly grumbling and griping about the trash pickup and groaning and moaning about the neighbor's yards. If you're a student, these are your fellow pupils who are constantly kvetching about how difficult a certain professor is, or grousing and squawking about how hard it is to get up for an 8 o'clock class. English has the perfect word to describe these inveterate grouches, querulous. Querulous, our next target word, is an adjective meaning full of complaints, complaining in an annoyed way. So if you're acting querulous, you're a whiner. You can use querulous to describe a person, their manner, and their actions. For example, his normally positive teenage daughter became querulous when she stayed up too late, complaining about her teachers, her social life, and even her parents. English has a number of other excellent words, like querulous, to describe people who show impatience or anger for no good reason, including peevish, petulant, testy, and carping. Use peevish to describe people who complain about petty or trivial things, like your aunt who can't stand when you use the wrong fork for your salad at Thanksgiving. Use petulant to describe behavior like that of a spoiled child. So for petulant, think of an adult throwing a temper tantrum when he didn't get the last scoop of ice cream. And if you're looking for the perfect verb to emphasize particularly mean-spirited, nasty criticizing, critiquing, and nitpicking, use the word carp. Okay, back to our target word, querulous. Can you think of a familiar word that's related to querulous? At first glance, it looks like querulous might be related to the word query, which means a question when used as a noun. However, querulous and query actually come from two different roots. Query comes from the Latin root usually spelled Q-U-I-R or Q-U-E-S, meaning ask or seek. You'll find this root in derived words like inquire, inquiry, question, quest, and request. Our key word for Q-U-E-S will be question, something you ask. Querulous, on the other hand, comes from the Latin word queror, meaning to complain. The related words quarrel and quarrelsome are derived from this same Latin word. So, if it helps you remember, write the word quarrel next to querulous in your vocabulary notebook. And note that querulous, complaining people can find themselves in a quarrel or argument if they take their incessant whining too far. So to remember querulous, make a connection to a whiner or belly acher that you know. If you can't think of someone, I want you to picture the most famous querulous complaining figure in all of TV history. You guessed it, Oscar the Grouch from Sesame Street. Oscar was querulous, always complaining about anything and everything from inside that garbage can. So try to avoid querulous people if you can help it. They'll suck the life right out of you. Now before we move on to our next target word, let's return to the Latin root Q-U-E-S for an interesting tidbit related to questions, or more specifically, to question marks. Interestingly, the ancient Romans didn't use question marks. Instead, Latin had specific words or word parts that were placed at the beginning of a sentence to indicate that the words that followed were going to ask a question. Have you ever read a sentence and didn't realize it was a question until the end when you saw the question mark? And then you had to reread that sentence with the proper inflection to make sense? Well, if we use this Latin approach, this linguistic heads up, to indicate questions at the beginning of the sentence, we wouldn't have this problem, would we? I mean, it makes you question our use of question marks, doesn't it? Okay, let's leave these annoying gadflies and these querulous colleagues behind us, and let's move on to the land of milk, honey, and sweet things. And I'm talking really sweet. Too sweet, in fact. So for our first target word in this too sweet category, I want you to ask yourself this question. Have you ever seen a movie or a play where the actors are overacting and the dialogue is just way too sentimental? Perhaps in a scene kind of like this. A down-on-his-luck bloke shuffles into a bar, lifts more than a few pints with the lads, and then starts getting all mushy and emotional with the bartender, spilling out his entire life story, telling everyone of his past loves, heartaches and regrets, and ending the night hugging the resident barfly, stating, "Hey, man, I love you, man." Our next target word perfectly captures this soppy, syrupy, slushy schmaltz. Maudlin. Maudlin is an adjective that means foolishly, tearfully, and weakly sentimental. Overly emotional. Maudlin's often used to describe sickly sweet sentiment resulting from drunkenness. Now, maudlin has a wonderful history that can help us remember its meaning. Maudlin is actually derived from an alteration of the woman's name, Magdalene, and actually came from the biblical Mary Magdalene, a woman from Magdala, a town on the Sea of Galilee. Now, Mary Magdala is one of the most prominent women described in the New Testament. According to the Bible, she had 7 demons cast out of her by Jesus, was present at his crucifixion, and was the first person to whom Jesus appeared after rising from the dead. Now, here's the important part of the story for our word. In the Middle Ages, Mary Magdalene was often depicted in paintings as a weeping, repentant sinner. This tearful image led to Maudlin's current figurative meaning of being overly sentimental that we use today. Okay, a quick note. Most biblical scholars today agree that Mary Magdalene was not the same person as the unnamed penitent woman depicted in the Bible as washing the feet of Jesus. Now, excellent synonyms and related words for maudlin and sentimental include schmaltzy, gushing, drippy, kitschy, which I really like, and hokey. Okay, we have a usage alert here. Mawkish is another rich synonym for maudlin, and it's our next target word. While both maudlin and mawkish share the common meaning of unduly or affectedly emotional, there's a small but important distinction in meaning between these two words. As described in the wonderful resource, Merriam-Webster's Dictionary of Synonyms, mawkish is an adjective that emphasizes the sickening nature of the sentiment. Mawkish sentiment is often disgusting and sickening because it's so incredibly insincere or over the top. So, our definition for mawkish is this: an adjective that means excessively and objectionably sentimental. Note the objectionable part of mawkish. Now, you can remember the sickening, disgusting connotation of mawkish from its etymology. Mawkish comes from the Middle English word M-A-W-K-E, which means maggot. Maggots. You can't get much more sick and disgusting than that. So in sum, if you want to emphasize too much sentiment that's disgusting because it's insincere, use mawkish. Remember, mock, maggot, disgusting. However, if you want to emphasize too much sentiment due to lack of self-restraint, implying drunkenness and crying, choose maudlin. Think maudlin. The crying Mary Magdalene seated next to the crying drunk bloke spilling out his life story. How's that for a visual? Let's review our first 4 target words: gadfly, querulous, maudlin, and mawkish. Okay, you're at the president of your company's retirement party. Jeff, the vice president, has never liked the president, and he's been after her job for years. However, Jeff's putting on a real show of being distraught, pretending to actually choke up during his toast, and even saying how much he's going to miss the president. What a crock. Everyone's disgusted at such a sickening display of false sentiment. Which word best describes Jeff's overly sentimental behavior? Maudlin or mawkish? Answer, because it's insincere and disgusting, mawkish. Okay, it's final exam week, and you're camped out deep in the college library, cramming for your next test. Then, Carrie shows up and tells you that only half the class passed the final exam last semester. She questions whether you've studied enough to pass, and even critiques your use of flashcards as an effective study technique. Which target word can we use to refer to such an annoying pest? Answer, gadfly. Okay, which target word, an adjective, describes whiners who are constantly complaining? Answer? Querulous. So let's move on from our midpoint review to our second set of four words. Now, we've already talked about two adjectives, maudlin and mawkish, that describe excessive sentimentality, but of slightly different types. However, we're going to explore a third type of excessive sentiment. Excessive sentiment that's just too darn sweet. English has the just right word for this too. Treacle. Treacle is a noun referring to cloying, sickly sweet speech or sentiment. You know treacle when you see it and hear it. Treacle can be sickly sweet writing, talking, or music. For example, how about the schmaltzy writing in those overly sentimental greeting cards you see in the grocery store like, "You are my everlasting soulmate, the yin to my yang, the rainbow to my cloudy day, the strawberry jam to my extra chunky peanut butter." That's treacle. Overly romantic movies could be described as treacle. So could those lovey-dovey sweet-nothings brand new boyfriends and girlfriends whisper to each other, calling each other hideously sweet nicknames that make you want to retch, like Jojo Bear and Poopsie Doll. At times, someone's being sickly sweet to you because they want something from you. Have you ever had that happen to you? You know what I mean. Perhaps it was when you were growing up, and your brother was being extra nice to you, asking if you needed help cleaning your room. I mean, come on. You knew something was up. He just wanted to play with your brand new G.I. Joe action figure with the kung fu grip, didn't he? But you saw right through your brother's contrived treacle, didn't you? All right, the adjective form of treacle is treacly. Synonyms and related words for treacly that also imply excessive sentiment, that sickly sweet, are cloying and saccharine. Use cloying if you want to emphasize the excessive and ingratiating nature of sickly sweet. Someone sucking up to you in a too sweet way. Now, treacle can also refer to molasses or golden syrup, which is a mixture of molasses, corn syrup, and sugar used as a table syrup or in cooking. That sounds pretty thick, sticky, and super sweet, doesn't it? So if this helps, I want you to visualize or even draw a picture of the sickly sweet syrup next to the word treacle in your vocabulary notebook. Okay, let's leave the land of the sickly sweet and move on to the world of the offensive and disgusting. This brings us to our next target word, scabrous. Now, do you think scabrous means A, scabby, blotchy, and scaly? Ugh. B, rough to the touch? Or C, indecent, shocking, scandalous? If you said A, scabby, you're right. Oh, but you're also right if you said B and C. It was a trick question. I know. I should have put D, all of the above, as an option. But we're going to focus on the last meaning I listed. Scabrous, our next target word, is an adjective that means dealing with or characterized by suggestive, indecent, or scandalous themes or material. Here's an example of scabrous in context. The intimate details of the late celebrity's scabrous diary shocked his family and ignited a scandal. You'll see scabrous used to describe indecent, risque, and obscene language and behavior. Synonyms and related words for this sense of scabrous include salacious, libidinous, and lascivious. Now, as with so many words, the etymology of scabrous can help us remember its meaning. So first, remember that scabrous can also be used to describe things that are literally rough, like sandpaper. Scabrous is also often used to describe skin that's scabby, blotchy, and scaly. Scabrous skin. Nice visual, huh? Scabrous originally comes from the Latin adjective scaber, meaning rough or scaly, which in turn is related to the verb scabo, meaning to scratch or scrape. Now, what other words do you know that look like they might be related to scabrous? Not surprisingly, scabrous is also related to not only the word scab, but also to scabies, the skin disease that makes you want to scratch that rough skin. So, the next time you see scabrous, I want you to think scabs, scabies, and scratching scaly skin. You getting itchy yet? And if you went on the town, out on the town with scabs and scabies and scales covering your body, it would be offensive and shocking to others, just like your scabrous behavior and language would. So I want you to write this connection down in your vocabulary notebook to help you remember this word. Okay, let's finish off today's lecture with two target words that you might encounter from time to time in print, but may not encounter frequently enough to be completely certain of their meanings out of context. Noisome and fulsome. All right, what do you think noisome means? Do you think noisome means A, full of loud, confused, disagreeable sounds, a clamorous racket, or B, offensive, disgusting? Before I tell you, let's see if putting noisome in context helps. The middle school boy had forgotten his lunch, which included a liverwurst and Swiss cheese on rye, in the bottom of his locker. A week later, the noisome owner had penetrated the teacher's lounge next door, sending the faculty scrambling out into the hallway, holding their noses. So as you can imagine and see, noisome, our next target word, is an adjective meaning offensive to the point of arousing disgust, foul, particularly in reference to an odor. Now, noisome odors are definitely malodorous, disgusting, and distasteful. Keep a can of air freshener handy when a noisome odor comes wafting your way. But now, noisome isn't only used to describe god-awful foul odors. You can also describe particularly offensive and disgusting people as noisome. Noisome also carries a second sense of noxious, harmful, or unwholesome. Synonyms and related words for noisome include loathsome, offensive, disgusting, and to emphasize the decaying and rotting aspects of disgusting smells, fetid and putrid. Ugh. Now, I know what you're thinking. So, Kevin, is noisome related to noise? Well, it looks like it should be related to noise, but it's not. Noisome is actually related to the word annoy. So to remember noisome, highlight the N-O-I in noisome in your vocabulary notebook and write the word annoy and connect it to the noi sound part you just highlighted and make a note that something that is noisome will annoy you so badly it's offensive and disgusting. So if noisome comes from annoy, where does noise come from? What's the word noise related to? According to the Online Etymology Dictionary and the Merriam-Webster New Book of Word Histories, noise comes from the old French word spelled the same way that means din, disturbance, uproar, or brawl. Now, this French word comes from the Latin nausea, meaning literally seasickness. So at this point, we've gone from noise to nausea to seasickness. So what's the connection? Well, if you've ever been seasick, and I have, you know what nausea is. And if you're on a crowded ship with a bunch of nauseous sailors creating a commotion or din, an uproar, you can see how noise developed from nausea. Now, the Latin word nausea comes from the Greek word nausea, meaning literally ship sickness. Look at that word, nausea. Do you see a root? Specifically, a sequence of three letters in the word that has something to do with ships? How about the N-A-U in words like nautical? The Greek root word N-A-U-S means ship. And this root gave us Jason's Argonauts, who were sailors of the ship Argo, the word astronaut, which literally means star sailor, and the word navy. So in sum, noise is related to nausea, nautical, and the Navy. Who would have thought? Okay, before we move on to our final target word, let's quickly review treacle, scabrous, and noisome using the definition clue activity. Okay, number one, this word can be used to describe suggestive, indecent, or scandalous movies or books. It can also be used to describe rough, blotchy skin. Answer? Scabrous. Number two, this word can be used to describe offensive and disgusting things, particularly odors. Answer? Noisome. Okay, number three. If you watch an overly sentimental, sickly sweet movie that makes you want to gag, what would you call it? This word is also used to refer to a thick, sweet syrup. Answer? Treacle. Now, a moment ago we explored the meaning of noisome, a word that can describe offensive smells. So it's pretty natural to move from there to a discussion of a skunk. Now don't worry, we're not talking about actual skunks here, but about our final word of the day, fulsome, which is a skunked term. What's a skunk term? Coined by the author, editor, and usage expert Brian A. Garner, a skunked term is a word or term that's undergoing a change in meaning or usage and is currently being disputed right now. Because not everyone agrees on the meaning of this word anymore, it should probably be avoided, just like a skunk. The story of fulsome is a delightful example of how word meanings shift and change over time. It also illustrates how this shift can cause arguments over what words should and can and do mean. Now, according to the Online Etymology Dictionary, originally fulsome was a Middle English compound of the prefix full, meaning full, and the suffix some, meaning tending to a considerable degree. So, full and some combined to form the original 13th century meaning of fulsome, abundant and full, or literally, full to a considerable degree. But as words do, the meaning of fulsome shifted over time, evolving from its original meaning of abundant and full to meaning plump and well-fed 100 years later. Now that meaning shift makes sense. If your table is always abundant and full, and you eat a lot, then you'll be plump and well-fed as a result, right? But fulsome didn't stop changing there. And about 200 years later, by the 1640s, it took on a negative connotation of being overgrown, overfed. Now that meaning change makes some sense too, doesn't it? I mean, if you're plump and well-fed, but just keep on eating and eating, you'll become overgrown and overfed, won't you? However, isn't it amazing that the same word can go from meaning abundant to overfed, from a positive to a negative connotation? But that's not the end of the story. Not even close. It only took a few decades by 1660 for the next change of meaning to occur. And as so often happens to many words, the literal meaning of fulsome as overfed was extended to the figurative meaning describing language that was so overdone as to be offensive to taste and good manners. So most dictionaries currently define fulsome as an adjective meaning excessively or insincerely lavish, offensive to good taste, especially as being grossly excessive. So according to this meaning, fulsome praise would not be a good thing, would it? It would mean that the praise was insincere and overdone. But many dictionaries also include a usage note because fulsome is changing once more at this very moment. For the fourth time. In an excellent article about fulsome on vocabulary.com, Aaron Brenner relates that by the 1940s and 50s, usage experts were criticizing the increasing use of fulsome to mean abundant, which was actually a return back to its original positive meaning, as in, she offered her wonderful boss fulsome praise. Usage mavens were fired up. Surely fulsome shouldn't be used in a positive sense. Many language speakers, on the other hand, didn't give a hoot. They kept on using fulsome to mean abundant. The battle was on. So now we've got a word that's in the middle of a linguistic tug of war between most language speakers and a few conservative prescriptive language authorities. Sounds like a rumble, doesn't it? In fact, according to Brian A. Gardner in his excellent resource, Garner's Modern American Usage, fulsome is at stage 4 of its language change index. Stage 4 means the form becomes virtually universal, but is opposed on cogent grounds by a few linguistic stalwarts. And once a word's at stage 4, the battle's lost. It looks like fulsome, meaning abundant, a positive sense, is here to stay, at least for now. Well, that wraps up today's discussion of annoying, disgusting, and sickly sweet words. So your homework assignment is to go forth into the wide world and find an example of at least one of the following in the next few days. A querulous gadfly who's constantly pestering, an overly sentimental maudlin crier, or something that's treacly, sickly sweet. And please stay away from noisome odors while you're at it. See you next time.
Lecture 5, Fighting Words and Peaceful Words.
Think back to a time when you had a disagreement with someone. Was it just a small tiff, a quarrel, or an outright family feud? And how about a time when you were in a serious, possibly physical altercation? Hopefully you haven't been in a fracas, a melee, or, and being Irish, I'm partial to this next word, a Donnybrook. English is replete with lively, hard-hitting words like these to describe all the different types of disagreements, disturbances, and commotions that we can get ourselves into, including words to describe aggressive, combative, and warlike behavior. Now, today's lecture focuses on such words, and as a bonus, we'll also learn a few words that take us in the opposite direction, words relating to peace and peaceful situations. Ah. And as usual, we'll delve into the morphology and etymology of many of the words we meet along the way, including examining two high-utility Latin roots that relate to war and peace. And we'll organize this lecture into three sections, fightin' words, war aggression words, and peaceful words. So, are you ready to rumble? Okay then, let's get started with a variety of hard-hitting, punchy words for fights, arguments, and commotions. For our first target word, imagine this. You're at a baseball game, and the pitcher purposely beans the batter, throwing the ball right at him and hitting him in the back. In rage, the batter throws off his batting helmet as he and his teammates storm the pitcher's mound. The pitcher's teammates rush from the dugout and into the fray to protect their pitcher. A no-holds-barred free-for-all ensues. There's a perfect word for this type of brawl. A Donnybrook. Donnybrook is a noun meaning a free-for-all, a brawl, a scene of disorder and uproar. Donnybrook's a wonderful word to describe a confused fight with everyone going at it. Visualize arms and legs sticking out at all angles from a pile of bodies. Donnybrook can also be used to describe a particularly contentious public quarrel or dispute. So let's listen to Donnybrook in context. The minor scrap between two hockey players quickly gave way to a Donnybrook, with everyone, including the two coaches, clearing the benches and going at it in the middle of the ice. Now, this word's etymological narrative is a gem. Donnybrook is a suburb of Dublin that was known for its annual fair and the many no-holds-barred, drunken, riotous brawls that took place during the fair. It became so bad, the fair was banned in 1855. I mean, have you ever been at a party like that? So when you hear the word Donnybrook, think of the Donnybrook Fair, perhaps some folks imbibing a little more than is good for them, and getting into a bare-knuckled, knock-down, drag-out brawl. Now, whenever I think of Donnybrook, I'm reminded of a quote about the Irish people's fondness for fighting by the great English writer G.K. Chesterton, who famously wrote, "The great Gaels of Ireland are the men that God made mad, for all their wars are merry, and all their songs are sad." Synonyms for Donnybrook that usually implied more serious, possibly, but not necessarily, violent physical disagreements include melee, which is a confused, rowdy fight or struggle, fracas, a noisy, disorderly disturbance and uproar. Now, this one could be a physical confrontation, but could also be a particularly noisy quarrel. Row, a noisy disturbance or quarrel, and a battle royal, a fisticuffs, a ruckus, and a rumpus. Now, in addition to these words that describe more serious, possibly violent physical disagreements, English also has some wonderful words to describe lesser disagreements of a possibly gentler nature, such as at loggerheads. You might be at loggerheads with a neighbor over the fence line between your two properties. And scrap, tussle, spat, and dust up. And this brings us to our next target word, imbroglio. Now, the pronunciation of this word can be a bit tricky. Some people mistakenly pronounce the G, which is silent, and some, like I did when I first learned this word, mistakenly pronounce the I-O at the end as an E-O in words like folio and polio. However, according to most sources, it's pronounced imbroglio. So, do you think an imbroglio is A, a battle royal, a violent free-for-all, or B, a complicated, confused situation or dispute? So listen to this word in the sentence to see if the context helps figure out its meaning. Mike was in love with his next-door neighbor, Rachel. But Rachel actually loved her accountant, Bob. Unfortunately for Rachel, Bob had just fallen head over heels for Tisha, whom he had just met at the coffee shop. However, much to Bob's chagrin, Tisha was married to Mike. Now, this is the type of imbroglio you'd only see in a romantic comedy from Hollywood. So if you said B, you were right. Imbroglio is a noun that refers to a state of great confusion and entanglement, a complicated, difficult, or embarrassing situation. Imbroglio can also refer to a complex misunderstanding, disagreement, or dispute, sometimes of a bitter nature. So let's take the root back to the root and tap into imbroglio's etymology to help us remember this word. Imbroglio comes from the Italian meaning confuse and is related to the English word embroiled. Imbroglio, embroiled. You can hear and see the relationship between these two words. Embroiled means thrown into a state of confusion. Now here's the best part. Imbroglio is also related to, get this, broil, which is related to broth and brew. Now we're talking. The spelling meaning connection in English once again provides us with a great visual image to help us remember imbroglio. So when you see the word imbroglio, I want you to focus like a laser on the B-R-O in the middle of that word. This is your key part. And think of broil and broth, two other words that share that bro. Now visualize a broiling broth with all the meat, fish, and vegetables, all jumbled and mixed up. And this will help you remember the distinguishing features of imbroglio, a confused, entangled mess. You might want to circle the B-R-O in imbroglio in your vocabulary notebook and write the words broth and broil next to it. You might even draw a picture of a jumbled up broiling broth to help you remember the meaning of a confused, complicated situation or disagreement. Now, this is a perfect example of how English has a built-in mnemonic system, its morphology and its etymology, that helps us remember words if we know how to look for it. Now, following are some excellent synonyms, our bonus words for imbroglio. Now, these words all describe some type of confused commotion or uproar. Now, just like imbroglio, these words don't necessarily have to involve a physical altercation, but they might. And they might also serve to describe a disagreement or dispute. One great synonym for imbroglio is a kerfuffle, a word of Scott Gaelic origin, also referring to a commotion, controversy, or fuss. And here are four more synonyms for imbroglio. And incidentally, I think all of these are just plain fun to say and sound like what they mean, a confused commotion. So in addition to kerfuffle, we have brouhaha, hullabaloo, and a great one that's not often used today, hurly-burly. A hurly-burly is a really loud, unruly, chaotic outburst or commotion. Now, back in lecture 1, I mentioned a 4-point scale of vocabulary knowledge. And you may rate many of the words that I've just mentioned, like at loggerheads and dust up, as twos or threes on that scale. You've heard them and probably know what they mean. They're in the receptive vocabulary section of your mental lexicon. But you may not actually use them a lot in your speaking or writing. That is, they aren't really in the expressive section of your lexicon. I mean, when's the last time you said something like, "Man, that last meeting sure caused quite a kerfuffle at the office"? So the next time you see a bench-clearing brawl during a hockey game, I want you to say, "That was quite a crazy Donnybrook." Or the next time your annoying cousin makes another one of his controversial comments at the next family reunion, say, "She's always causing a hullabaloo wherever she goes." These are exactly the types of underused words that we need to take out of our linguistic closets, shake off the dust, and start wearing around the house again. Okay, let's take a moment for a quick review. I'll describe a situation and provide one of the vocabulary words that we just discussed. You decide if a target word applies to a given situation. Okay, situation one. You're at a baseball game, and an inebriated fan for the opposing team walks up to you and starts pushing you. You push back. He calls you a few names, and as the security guards come and take the man away, he lightly slaps you on the side of the face. So true or false, this altercation is best described as a Donnybrook. If you said false, you're correct. A Donnybrook is usually used to describe a violent brawl involving many people. Because your altercation only involved two people and wasn't all that violent, you could better describe it as a scrap, a tussle, or maybe a dust-up. Situation two. At a faculty meeting, the high school principal announces that the art and music programs will be undergoing cuts. And this is the very night after the school board announced fully funding the construction of a brand new state-of-the-art football stadium. Now, this leads to a heated debate among the teachers and sets off quite a commotion in the community, with families and neighbors at odds. Is this situation best described as an imbroglio or a melee? If you said imbroglio, you're right. An imbroglio is a confused situation or disagreement. A melee implies a confused, rowdy fight, often of a physical nature. Now, before we move on, you might want to organize these fighting words in your vocabulary notebook into three different categories. Words referring to more serious physical altercations, like melee and Donnybrook. Words referring to less serious physical altercations, like tussle and scrap. And words implying commotions and confused situations, like kerfuffle and imbroglio. Now that we've discussed different words for commotions and fights, let's look at four target words that are related to aggressive behavior. Bellicose, truculent, contumacious, and rapacious. And to get us started, I'm going to say a few words. See if you can identify the common root that they all share. Okay, ready? Here we go. Bellicose, belligerent, antebellum, rebellion, and bellona. If you said bell, you're correct. The root B-E-L-L is from the Latin noun bellum, meaning war. Bellona, by the way, was the Roman goddess of war. Our target word for bell is bellicose, an adjective that means warlike, pugnacious, aggressively hostile. A bellicose person is spoiling for a fight. Think of the local bully that you knew back in middle school, that kid swaggering around the halls with a chip on his shoulder. Now here's a context sentence. The general's bellicose rhetoric heightened tensions along the border between the two countries. Now, to help you remember that bell means war, a good keyword for the root bell is rebellion. Write this down in your vocabulary notebook. The re at the beginning of the word rebellion is the Latin prefix meaning back or again, as in redo, to do again. So, a rebellion involves rebels, people who have lost the war but want to make war again, to overcome their conquerors. Now, bell is a fertile root from which a number of rich vocabulary words are derived. Belligerent is a close synonym for bellicose that shares the root bell, and also means warlike and aggressively hostile. Antebellum and postbellum are two other words derived from bell. Now, the Latin prefix ante means before. So antebellum means before the war. And its converse, postbellum, means after the war. The Latin prefix post means after. Okay, let's proceed to our next target word, truculent. Like bellicose, is related to aggression. Truculent is an adjective that means cruel, savage, brutal and fierce, disposed to fighting. It can also mean scathingly and brutally harsh, often referring to someone's words or criticism. Here's truculent in context. The literary critic's truculent criticism of the revered author's 10th novel, stating that it wasn't worth the paper it was printed on,